and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Alfred Hitchcock and his 1953 film, I Confess. Returning on the show today to talk about I Confess is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So it's interesting that we chose this film because this is not a film that a lot of people, I even think a lot of Hitchcock fans, have seen. I think it's definitely one of his most, because we talked about how Spellbound is very underrated. I think this film is just underseen. Because I've like vaguely heard about it. Like, it's some movie he did in the 50s with Montgomery Clift, and that's all I know.
Yeah, I don't think most people have seen this movie. It's but I think it's kind of an uneven movie. Hitchcock had hoped it would be funny.
It does not come off at all.
And even he admitted in the end that he was very disappointed in it because the jokes didn't work. Like the way the bicycle keeps falling over. Yeah, it's supposed to be funny. It doesn't work.
No.
We talked about that a little bit when we were talking about Suspicion, how there were moments in the film that were amusing, that kind of break the tension. And that doesn't happen in I Confess. I think that contributes to it being sort of a lost gem. Mm-hmm.
So why did you want to do this movie? What brought you to talk about this on the show?
I think it's an interesting movie because it's the perfect example of the transference of guilt. And besides, it has Montgomery Clift in it, mm-hmm. before his accident.
Yeah, it was interesting you talk about Montgomery Clift because I was looking up. He's kind of in the field of like a Brando or somebody who kind of started the method acting technique, which reading about it, I guess that did not gel over well at all with Hitchcock. But I've seen this in Red River of his. I know he was stuff like Duel in the Sun, a couple of other films with Liz Taylor. And it seems like his career he died very young, but it seems like he just fell off after that. He didn't really have a very long career. Was it all because of that accident?
Yeah, he had a terrible automobile accident. And after a two-month recovery, his face was messed up.
Oh,
so
yeah,
he was never, he still looked pretty good. I mean, let's face it, he's Montgomery Clift. He looked like an ordinary, attractive man, but not. He could never get over the fact that he lost that. In fact, in Hollywood, they called it the longest suicide ever because he just drank himself to death, which started from then for, the pain, but also it was just his coping mechanism. And at one point, speaking of alcohol stories and brandy, because it's Hitchcock once dared him to drink a whole carafe of brandy, which he did, and then promptly passed out. He was, I guess, depressed for a lot of years and a recluse. He co-starred with Marilyn Monroe in The Misfits in 61. Yeah. And Monroe said, and all the problems she was having, she described him as the only person I know who is in even worse shape than I am.
Oh, wow.
So he was, the golden boy. He was beautiful to look at. He made several terrific movies, and then the accident, and then basically it was a long, slow decline. It's a very sad story.
And do you think what also hurt his career was the fact that maybe some people blackballed him for the fact that he was gay?
That could be true, but he was not open about it. They did want to cast him in Rope as one of the young men, and he said he didn't want to because he didn't want to. People to think that he was gay.
That is so sad. And he died. Did he get a car accident like James Dean, or was that somebody else?
It was in 56 when he had the crash. And James Dean, of course. Yeah. Everybody was driving really badly in the 50s, I guess.
And so you talked a little bit earlier how you feel this film is underseen. It's because of just, any attempts at comedy, which I didn't get any laughs at this film at all. I mean, it's a good film, but yeah, I didn't get any laughs. You think that's the main reason why it's underseen, or is there something else you feel that's missing from other great, because this came in the 50s, so if something, other great Hitchcock films like Strangers on a Train or Rear Window or so on and so forth.
I know that some people who watched it didn't understand that a priest cannot reveal what is confessed, so they had problems with the movie for that reason, which contributed to maybe not being as well received. But the French New Wave, those people love this movie because it does have that sort of quirky, different spin on a story.
Yeah, and it's a quirky little spin. First of all, it's not set in America. It's set in Quebec. Not a lot of Hollywood movies get set in Quebec. And, it's about this priest but he's, the whole thing is that he's got out up in this, quote-unquote scandalous relationship with this other woman. And, you know, it's definitely a bit off kilter.
It's a great story in terms of one of those, you know, terrible secrets from the past that you hope are never revealed, which are always revealed. And, you know, in the worst way possible.
I think it also helps to feel like this is probably one of the closest films Hitchcock gets to a noir, because I don't think he's ever gotten full film noir. But if you had to do it, I would say this is one that's very close, because especially that opening scene, it's all set in dark. You actually see Hitchcock walking across the camera, mm-hmm. but it's all dark. It's at night. There's a lot of use of shadows, like when the German guy confesses that he's killed this guy. You know, it's all set in light. He's in light, but everything's all this dark and everything. It almost feels like you're watching a film noir.
Yeah, I agree. It does have that feel to it. And also that, you know, starting off by going in the window, like looking at something secret, another Hitchcock device. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gives you that idea of you're about to see something you're not supposed to see.
You were talking a lot about Montgomery Clift. The other lead star in this film is Ann Baxter. And I also feel that, you know, you look at her IMDb, it's just like, wow, a lot of great roles. But she's never one of all the great golden age actresses of that generation, 30s, 40s, 50s. She's never one that's talked about a lot. And yet she probably played one of the most iconic villains ever as Eve in All About Eve.
Yeah, I had forgotten that she was in that movie when I saw her in this one, because I keep confusing her with Clara Trevor.
Yeah, they do look a little bit alike.
And Clara Trevor has done a lot of Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, so I keep getting them mixed up. Clara Trevor would have been great in this role, too, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And she did quite a lot of film noir.
Yeah, she was in a film called Murder, My Sweet, which is based off a Raymond Chandler novel. She was in Key Largo, and she was in some other movie. I forget, it was like 99 River Street or something. Raw Deal, I think, was the one that's called. But yeah, she did a lot of. She could definitely play like a femme fatale blonde.
Yeah, and in this situation, she's a reluctant femme fatale. She doesn't want to, you know, hurt anybody. She's not, you know, there to be a villain. But she is actually, I think, the most ill-used character in the film, because she ends up having to reveal
everything.
All this stuff, and then they don't even. You know, it doesn't help anything. All it does is ruin her reputation.
Yeah, it just hurts her character. And it's interesting, like that, you know, one of the things that was at the very end when, you know, the bad guy finally reveals that he's the one that killed the lawyer. And it seems, you know, and it's almost like she looks at it and she gets a sense of relief and she goes back to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, what did you interpret out of that scene? Does that mean that she's just, you know, now that it's over with, she can just move on with her life and she's, you know, she can put on the past, her past with Logan behind her?
Well, we have to imagine that Logan has definitely decided he doesn't want to give up the priesthood. You know, mm-hmm. He's had the chance to think that over when he's walking around trying to decide what to do. And there's a great scene where he's looking in on a department store window and it's got a suit. And he's standing in such a way that he can see himself in the suit. Like, I could just be a regular guy, just goes mm-hmm. to work in a regular suit. I can make that choice, but he doesn't.
Mm-hmm. You bring up a good point. How like a lot of people were confused. Like, well, why doesn't he just tell him who the killer is? Why does he? And I think I was reading Hitchcock actually talked about that scene, because he was like, people who are, you know, Catholic, you know, priests or, you know, in the Catholic Church are going to be like, they'll understand that. But everybody else of every different religion, like, oh, I wouldn't do that. I just go to the cops.
Well, Hitchcock was Catholic and was raised by Jesuits, so this is familiar territory for him. But not everybody does understand that. Even when I'm watching it, I'm thinking, why doesn't he pressure the guy to
himself at least do that? Like, yeah. I'm sure that wouldn't be breaking any rules.
Right.
Yeah. And you talk about it, like, you actually went like a week ago when you first warmed me up for this, you talk about, you know, Hitchcock was Catholic. And it was interesting, you know, Hitchcock and religion in movies you'd never really. Here, you know, this is one of his, probably the first movie of his that he's ever really addressed religion.
Except if you want to think about Vertigo, you know, there's nuns in it.
Yeah.
Nun subplot. But yeah, this is really the only movie where he really addresses the crux of Catholicism and how that would play into a murder mystery.
Yeah.
Somebody knows something but can't reveal, and then they're suspected of doing it and they can't clear themselves. It's a great wrong man setup.
Yeah, and I have to ask you, what did you hear anything, like, what was the reception from the Catholic Church at this time? Because I know, you know, there actually was a whole committee on the Catholic Church of what, you know, they would.
The Legion of Decency.
Yeah, Legion of Decency. So they would be ready to mark any film that they would feel is indecent. So I have to feel that they must have had, you know, because they would get very upset about a lot of movies at that time. And today we watch, like, what's the big deal? Were they upset at this movie?
It was actually banned in Ireland because the priest had had a relationship with this woman, even though it was before he was a priest. There was actually a different actress that Hitchcock was interested in using in the main role instead of Anne Baxter. But they discovered that she had, you know, some sort of, I think she was married before or divorced or something that at the time was considered too scandalous. So Anne Baxter got the part. And I think Montgomery Clift is really good in this in that he's very unshakable. You know, you don't really see him fighting with revealing anything. You see him fighting with not revealing. And since he's a method actor.
Very contained. And you could feel like it's a bit bearing on him, but he's holding it all in and he wants to let it out, but because of that relationship that he can't.
Yeah. You mentioned that you wondered if Hitchcock had difficulty working with him because he was a method actor. There's a scene where he walks out and looks up at the hotel that's across the Hotel du Nord, which is across the huge parking lot full of people. And so Hitchcock says, so when you walk out the door, I want you to look up. And then he cuts so it shows where he's going. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, people aren't going to know why he's going over there. And he says, well, I don't think I would look up. And he says, well, yeah, you are going to look up because that's what I need. They went back and forth, but I don't think it's natural. But I don't think he was as methodical as Claude Rains, who actually, you know, counted how long, you know, with the coffee cup and stuff. So there's different levels of method acting.
Yeah, it's funny that they had this, all that bickering over just some scene that's just completely, you know, small and minor.
Although it works. You know, when it comes out, that pause is, to me, it's not so much about showing you where he's going, but it gives you a chance to look out over that whole crowd and see, okay, to get from there to there, he's got to go through this whole crowd of people. And looking up, I think, is something that a priest would do all the time. You'd always be looking up.
Oh, yeah. And talking about the buildings you're talking about, it's interesting, like a lot of the shots he does with the buildings are sort of either very unusual angles, that they're very low, you know, low angle shots that they're covering the entire frame, or they're very kind of Dutch angles to where everything's off kilter, which reminds me a lot of the Vienna shots in The Third Man. And once again, that helps contribute to a film noir setting.
And also he's trying to get to the bottom of, you know, what church, you know, has the priest who is guilty of this. So they go to different churches and they show all these different angles, and it's like cross cutting, you know, and everything's leaning. So it's sort of like, maybe it's this way. No, maybe it's this way.
A little kind of similar to the scene in Psycho when Abergast is investigating all the hotels, and it's a montage. Everybody's saying, nope, nope, nope. And then boom, he finally gets to the Bates Motel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I also want to talk about the character of Otto, because I do feel that this is definitely one of the most despicable villains like in a Hitchcock movie, because there's just nothing likable about him. First of all, he tells Montgomery Clift that he's killed somebody, and then gets upset when he figures out, well, that might be a problem. But then like, well, then why did you tell him in the first place? But just the way he tells him this, and even though Clift doesn't do anything, he's getting on him all the time and calling him a coward, and he's just completely reprehensible. I thought he was a horrible human being.
Horrible human being. And who confesses to someone and then also frames the guy?
Yeah, just awful.
Frame a different person, right? Just honor among thieves, if nothing else. Yeah, what a evil character, but just a scared person. You know, you can see that's what a lot of people would do. They would save their own skin.
Yeah, it's desperation that they would just dig themselves, you know, just find any way to get out of it, even if it is setting up people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and ruining people's lives. The wife named Alma, I think, was an homage to his wife.
Oh, really?
It's the only time he's had a character in one of his movies named Alma. So I think that was meant to make her, you know, the ultimate woman. Like, you wouldn't want to disappoint her. And he would do anything to protect her.
So besides Anne Baxter, Montgomery Clift, or the horrible character of Otto, is anybody else that sticks out to you, that anything that stands out? One thing in my notes that I said really stands out to me is Carl Malden's nose. But
what about his nose?
You never noticed the joke? Like, he's always got the big, Carl Malden's nose is always huge.
I've never noticed that.
Really?
No, I've never noticed that, but I'm going to have to look now. Now it's probably going to seem obvious.
Yeah, it's going to be really obvious. I mean, I looked it up. I guess I think he got a couple of fights as a kid, so his nose got busted, so it grows big. But, like, yeah, that's always been the joke about Carl Malden. He's got a big nose. But...
He makes a good G-man.
Oh, yeah, he always kind of plays the good, you know. It was funny because...
The no-nonsense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was funny when I was watching this film, and, you know, the other guy's a priest and he's a cop. I kept thinking of his priest character in On the Waterfront, and, you know, he's the guy that's trying to clean up the docks and make everything straight and get rid of corruption.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's great at that.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to show you the there's a Family Guy clip. Or Peter's talking about, this is worse than that time I did cocaine with Carl Malden. And the joke is because Carl Malden's got a big nose, so he keeps snorting up his entire supply.
Yeah, that joke would work. The one thing I think is kind of a weak spot in the film is the backstory, the love story. It's told in this very soft focus, very 50s idealized love story. And before Montgomery Clift goes off to war, you know, they are involved. And then when he decides, you know, I want to join the priesthood, he seems very cold. I found that scene is very hard to reconcile
for
me.
The scene when they're at the gazebo?
Yeah, he very easily puts aside the past.
Yeah, and the whole flashback it goes on for quite
forever.
Some time. And I do think you could have just shrunk that to the part where we get it, they had a thing, and move on, you know, but you keep going on and on and on in this flashback where I remember when we were in love.
Yes.
And it just goes
yes.
on like that. Maybe that's one of the things that really brings this movie down.
Well, and I think what brings it down is because you're not really sure, because Montgomery Clift is so buttoned up. His emotions are so in check. You don't know if what she's saying is, oh, we know we were so in love, or, oh, I was. Mm-hmm. Was he? I mean, you can't really tell.
No, definitely.
And you don't know if she was just clueless the whole time, like, yeah, I'm so going to be a priest and I'm not into you. You would think that would not be such a surprise.
And she even says, like, all the time he was so serious, so maybe he just never was into her in the first place.
Yeah, it does make you wonder. I think that's the flaw. And I do feel sorry for her husband, who is, you know, trying so hard to stand by her. And he understands about the past, but, you know, everything's being made public. It's humiliating. They really leave that couple holding the bag.
Yeah, and I guess at the end, it's sort of like she's finally moved on from Montgomery Clift. I guess she's going to be okay with Pierre now?
I think she kind of would have been all along if she had been able to give up on Montgomery Clift earlier. But this is, you know, they talk about this movie being about the transference of guilt. And I think most people think of Otto transferring his guilt to the priest. But I also think that the young couple, Montgomery Clift and the Anne Baxter character, end up kind of they get the guilt secondhand from Otto and his wife. You know, their guilt ends up being, they end up having to pay for it forever and carry around, you know, what happened.
Yeah, and so talk more about this relationship between Clift and Baxter. Do you think, the thing is they say, well, we never really did anything, you know. Do you think that there was more than we see, like they consummated, let's say?
I would say no, because I would say no, because I can't believe he would really join the priesthood if he was really into women and doing that. And it was the 50s when people had to be more circumspect just for reputation and fear of disease and pregnancy and all those things. So I think not, but I think that there was some, it would have spiced things up a bit had there been a pregnancy scare, and then we would have known, and it would have been that much more scandalous. And then, you know, what if they hid it and maybe she had the baby? You could have gone so many directions with the natural consequence, especially if it had happened before he left and then he didn't even know about it. And she didn't know if he's coming back. And, you know, you could have done so much with that.
Yeah, but then also you would have to do a lot of juggling with it, because that could easily get into soapy melodrama.
I think it's already pretty soapy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that the backstory really is very, like, you know, soft lit.
And even that opening scene when we first see them as, you know, teenagers in love or whatever, it's very in slow motion. She's walking down the stairs, and that just felt really silly.
Yes, with the music swelling and the sun coming up and backlighting her. Yes, it's very artificial. But that kind of works with the film noir. Just in the midst of this sort of dark story, there's this unlikely bit of light. And maybe that's why she held the torch for so long. But, you know, I would think when the guy comes back and says, you know, I'm joining the priesthood, it's over.
Yeah, even just kind of like, you know, like a lot of noirs, like, you always want that urge to get back to the things were like before World War II, but knowing that things are never going to be the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so,
what did you think? Did you think they had consummated the relationship?
I don't think so. But like the whole thing, everybody was thinking that. So maybe they did, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I think Montgomery Clift's character is meant to be so righteous that mm-hmm. I think that sort of flaw would have made him decide he just wasn't a candidate for the priesthood. That's how I read the character. I do think it's very Hitchcockian and interesting the way he keeps showing the back of Montgomery Clift's neck.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot.
Yeah, because you're thinking about strangling and, you know.
Even like the way you see
stabs it in the back. And
yeah, like even the opening scene in Notorious when you see Cary Grant's character just from the back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the silhouette. Like, who is that mysterious man?
Yeah, and well, I think I talked a lot about how it was interesting that this film was, you know, it was a Hollywood movie, but it's set in Quebec. I believe this play was made by a French-Canadian. It's Paul Anthelime. You have anything to add to that? Have you ever read it?
I know that in the play, the priest was hanged. Mm. So he actually, you know, takes the rap. But they had to eliminate it because, you know, get it by the censors.
So in that play, did they still get Otto? Did they still get the bad guy?
You know, I haven't seen the play.
Okay.
I just know that one fact that I think that would be very disturbing.
Yeah, that he gets away with it. That'd be really dark.
Yeah, or even that he doesn't get away with it, but the priest ends up paying for it anyway.
And going back a little bit to Otto, now, I was wondering if this film was pulling a little bit on World War II paranoia, because he's German, and he talked about, mm-hmm. Nobody else would want to take in an immigrant fleeing the war, a German immigrant or something. You're the only one who did that for me. It was almost a little... I wonder if it was a little bit playing on the paranoia that, you know, that there are still Germans out there who are still, you know, want to bring back the Nazi party, and they might be here in America.
And even if you help them, then they're going to turn on you and make mm-hmm. you pay for their crimes and stab you in the back. Yeah, there's definitely that theme in there.
And I was reading, it was interesting that this was the longest pre-production that any Hitchcock film ever made. It was, because it took 8 years for him to write, and I bet you, like a lot of you said, he was disappointed. I bet a lot of that was disappointment. Like, I spent so much time in my life trying to get this movie made, and most people don't even remember it.
Yeah, and I think he also was hoping to do something with that Catholic theme, because he probably thought that's just a terrible situation to be in. And, mm-hmm. and he likes that, take a regular person and throw them into something extreme. But I think no matter how long he worked on it, whatever he thought was going to come out funny, it wasn't funny. I mean, I think it's a great movie, but it's not funny.
Yeah, definitely. There's no humor in there. And even that, the only bit of comic relief I see with the fact that the one of the priests has the bike that keeps falling down, like, you don't get that big a laugh out of it.
No, and it seems like, what's wrong with the bike?
I mean, you know, compare it to some of the more comedic elements, and even something like Rear Window, where, you know, you have the young couple in that mm-hmm. little room, and the windows are always closed. Like, that's funny because
we
all know what's going on, but Hitchcock isn't explicitly telling you.
Yeah, very tongue-in-cheek. And nudge and a wink.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit about how this was a religious, you know, this was one of the few Hitchcock films that, you know, take on the topic of religion. What was Hitchcock's relation? I know he was Catholic, but... did he ever really express his views or anything? I don't know a lot about his opinions on religion.
Well, I think that there is a Catholic storyline that is in all of his movies, in that, you know, the good and evil and the duality of nature and, you know, the tendency we all have to do bad things and coming around to justice. But I don't think it comes off necessarily definitively Catholic, because those are sort of,
that could be anybody.
But in this, he definitely tries to bring in the Catholic aspect of it, because you have that element of whatever you tell this person is like sacrosanct. They can't tell anybody, even if it's something as terrible as I killed somebody.
We're talking a lot about this film and sort of its relationship to other Hitchcock film classics in the 50s or even early 60s. Do you feel that we both like this film, don't get us wrong, but do you feel that, put this up against some of his better known stuff in the 50s, that it's just in a completely different league?
It is in a different league. And I think one of the things that hurts it in a way, I think it would have, if he had made another movie with Montgomery Clift or with Ann Baxter, then it would have been, you know, like the other one or the other two where you could see them doing Hitchcock movies. Since it's just a one-off, you kind of have to discover it. You don't discover it because you're looking at all of Jimmy Stewart's movies or all of Cary Grant's movies with Hitchcock or all the Grace Kelly you can find. You know, you'd have to seek it out. It'd have to be, well, that's the only Montgomery Clift movie I haven't seen, or you know, this is the Montgomery Clift movie that he made with Hitchcock. You'd have to
go out of your way to find it.
Yeah, you'd have to go out of your way. And I haven't seen it in a lot of box sets, although you said you got it as part of one.
I found it in a Turner Classic Movie box set. I think I actually found it like at the grocery store for like $6. So it was a pretty big bargain. But yeah, you get that. You get Suspicion, which we did. You got The Wrong Man, which is another underrated one from the 50s. And then you get Strangers on a Train. So you get a pretty good collection. So you probably can find it now.
Now, when Turner Classic Movies, though, they tend to colorize things. So is your copy of Suspicion in color?
Oh, no, it's black and white.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I know that Lena's wearing a green velvet dress, because I've seen the colorized one.
I do think they've got – I know back in the early days, like especially Ted Turner, they were doing that a lot. But I think now that they're just like, if it's black and white, keep it black and white.
Yeah, keep it black and white.
Yeah, don't do that. That's stupid. Anything else that we haven't discussed that you want to bring up now?
Well, in terms of Montgomery Clift's character, did you find that you wanted him to be a little more open? Like, I wanted him to say something a little more sympathetic to Ann Baxter.
Yeah, I wanted him to emote a little bit more. He was too contained. I mean, somebody keeping in all of this, he would have some sort of breakdown or just something. Or even something where he's just getting angry at God for putting this on him, or just something.
Yeah, some scene where you see him struggling with this choice. Like, you know, the James Dean scene in Rebel Without a Cause, where it's like, you're tearing me apart. You could see that happening with with Otto. Like, some sort of very emotional scene, but he doesn't. Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about you're tearing me apart scene, have you ever seen The Room? Okay, it's one of the worst movies ever made, but there's a scene where they're doing that. He's trying to do a James Dean. He goes, "You're tearing me apart, Lisa," and he does it horribly. But because every time I see Rebel Without a Cause and they're doing that, I just laugh because I'm thinking of The Room.
It's such an iconic scene. But at least he's, you know, at least he's putting that out there. But yeah, Montgomery Clift's character is just so very, very buttoned down. Or even, you know, a moment of levity with the cops, you know, even.
Yeah, just kind of maybe like a goofy comic relief character or something.
Right. Or even say what I think somebody would say was like, even if I did know something, I couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. I would think you'd at least throw them off the scent by saying, you know, the confessional is sacred. I can't reveal anything that has been said there, but make it obvious that you know something that you can't reveal.
Mm-hmm. Or even just a scene where he blows up at Otto and he goes like, you know what you're doing to me, you know, I can't reveal this, but you know what you're doing to me, just something where he breaks down, just to show that he's a little bit human and not, they always make him seem almost a bit Christ-like.
Yeah, and robotic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is one of the flaws. I think that's one of the reasons why if you watch it, it's not necessarily one you go back to.
Okay. And so last question I'll have is just tell us if you bring this film? I know you teach a Hitchcock class. Do you, when it's on, do you bring this into it?
I like to bring this one in, or The Wrong Man, one that is sort of a forgotten movie with this wonderful theme of, you know, The Wrong Man, which has also been explored in The Lodger.
Mm-hmm. Or almost like every Hitchcock
movie.
Almost
every Hitchcock movie. Yeah, he likes that idea of that transference of guilt, that somebody does something, but someone else takes it on. And how do you do that better than with a Catholic priest?
All right. Well, that wraps up this week's episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Alfred Hitchcock and his 1953 film, I Confess. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 7, Saturday at 1, or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westay, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, I never thought of the priesthood as an offering, a hiding place.